his name. Amen. All right, so we are, we're doing a little historical survey. Last week we finished up with the 8th century, so I want to talk now about the 11th and 12th century. 11th and 12th century would be the 1000s and the 1100s, okay? So it took me a while to figure that out when I was in grade school, I remember. Well, why isn't 1100s the 11th century? Well, that's because the first century didn't have any ones in it, just tens, or and no hundreds. So, around 1000. So, when the church got to about 1000 A.D., there was a fair amount of hysteria. We were all alive when the calendar turned to 2000. You remember the insanity that went on during that time? It was the same at 1000. And the funny thing is that it's an arbitrary number. Jesus absolutely was not born in zero. He absolutely was not. Most likely he was born maybe 3 B.C., 5 B.C., somewhere. So again, to mark this notion that that 1,000 years has more significance than it ought was true at the turn of the first millennia and then equally at the turn of the second millennia. How did they start that calendar? It was the Roman calendar that was adopted, and it got modified during the time. I don't know if it was during Constantine's reign or it was shortly after that. But once the Roman Empire and the Roman Catholic Church sort of were synonymous, they got put together so that the Roman calendar, which we follow, then marked its time by when they thought Jesus was born. So B.C. before Christ, anno Domine, in the year of our Lord, right? So if you're talking about dates before Christ was born, you put B.C. at the end. If you're talking about dates like now, we live in A.D. 2017, in the year of our Lord 2017. So that's sort of how we mark our calendar. Beyond that, again, you know, we talked last week that the Islamic calendar began in 622 when Muhammad fled to Medina. So in that 11th century, just shortly after the turn of the first millennia, there was a growing concern among European Christians that the Holy Land needed to be retaken from the Muslims. The Muslims had taken that land, and there was this growing sense that the Holy Land needed to be recaptured for Christ's sake. And so that led to we'll call it 7 Crusades, although the way that we count them and number them, it gets a little fuzzy and complicated during that time. Some of them were partially successful. Some of them were utter failures. And I'll try to go through these rather quickly. The first crusade began in 1096, and it lasted for 3 years. Pope Urban the First, I believe, was the one who called the church to go in military exercises to retake the Holy Land. And Jerusalem actually fell to the Crusaders in 1099. So the first crusade was probably the most successful in terms of what it was setting out to do. Now, the Crusades added a whole host of other issues. It really gave rise to indulgences, and we'll talk about indulgences when we look at the Roman Catholic Church particularly. But one of the ways, in fact, probably the most effective recruiting tool that the church had at that time was to say, well, if you go on this crusade, you don't have to go to purgatory. You go straight to heaven when you die. Okay? So there was that sense in the first crusade. The second crusade began in 1147, and it also was 1147 to 1149, 2 years. When the first crusade concluded in 1099 with the capture of Jerusalem, the Holy Land got partitioned into, particularly the western part of the Holy Land, got partitioned into various strongholds. You had Jerusalem, you had Edessa, Antioch, and Tripoli. So those were the main cities, main cities, if you will, of the Holy Land. So in 1144, Edessa fell to the Muslims again. You know, they didn't stop fighting. They kept sort of wrangling back and forth. So when Edessa fell in 1144, King Louis VII of France and King Conrad III of Germany called for a second crusade to go and recapture Edessa. Interestingly, are we up? Hey, we're up. Yes.
When you said that indulgence
is, yes,
I don't know a lot about it, but what do you do then with the verse that Paul says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord?
Yes, thank you, Andy. So what do you do with the verse that says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord in connection to this whole issue of indulgence and purgatory? And the argument is pretty simple. It doesn't say immediately. Right? It just says to be absent from the body is to be present with the Lord. And they would say, well, of course, but you might have to spend some time in purgatory in order to ultimately get there. We'll deal with indulgences because that was, and I want us to really look at it. We're going to celebrate, I think rightly so, we're going to celebrate the 500th anniversary of Luther's 95 Theses this year. And there's a reason why we are gathered here and we're not part of the Roman Catholic Church. And one of the main reasons, in fact, most of the 95 Theses had to do with indulgences. Because what it did was it cheapened grace. It sort of undermined this notion that you came to Jesus by faith alone. And so we'll look at the five solas and all of those things. Judith, don't restart. Oh, it's not responding. Of course it's not. Go ahead and restart it, and then I'll just keep talking. Yes, Cindy. Are the indulgences a Catholic thing? Well, primarily they are. They developed within the Roman Catholic Church, and primarily they developed after the split, the great schism in the that would have been the 10th century when the East and the West split. So you end up with the Orthodox Church and the Roman Catholic Church, and so those developed after that. It was during the 10th century that you had the issue of transubstantiation growing. So you have lots of things going on within the context of the Roman Catholic Church. And one of those things that's going on, it has to do with the Crusades. I mean, I think last Sunday in the sermon, I made reference to Churchill and Stalin overseeing the military might that were, you know, and Stalin said, how many of these does the Pope have? And the reality is today, none. I mean, he has a little sort of police force in Vatican City. But in this day, what kind of might did the Pope have? He had the biggest army in the world, is what he had. Yes, Cindy.
Isn't the Crusades are through the Pope and the Church?
So the Crusades are through the Pope and through the Church, and so that's why. And it's important for us, the first crusade being called by Pope Urban, so he calls the first one. The second one is called by King Louis VII and King Conrad III, both of whom were connected to the Holy Roman Empire. So they had that power to call these. Yes. In 1149, the forces of Louis VII and Conrad III turned their attention on Damascus, one of the other areas in the Holy Land, and they were utterly defeated. Utterly defeated. I suppose I should say this. There's a reason why we're looking at the Crusades, because for us, that's just a, those are pages in a history book. If I'm a Muslim, those aren't pages in a history book. And we need to understand that that has, it does have an impact on today. It does have an impact on today. I'll try to connect the dots. Hopefully today I will do that. All right, the Third Crusade, 1187 to 1192. There were still factions within the Muslim world, but they were predominantly ruled by these caliphs. We looked at that last week, and one of the sort of the high ups in Islam at that time was a man named Shirkah, and he, along with his nephew Saladin, captured Cairo in 1169. So they began to take North Africa again. Again, there are skirmishes going back and forth between the various factions. So in 1169, Shirkah and Saladin take Cairo, and when Shirkah dies, Saladin becomes the military arm of the Muslims at that time. And he, in 1187, sets his sights on Jerusalem, because the Crusaders still have forces there. They're still maintaining control of Jerusalem. Primarily, they did that through two orders. We'll call them orders. One of them we know probably pretty well, usually through maybe Indiana Jones movies. The Knights Templar. Okay, I got it. Thank you. Are we working? Yes, there we are. The Knights Templar, we all familiar with that. So that was one of the groups that was, it was an order of the Crusaders. The other one, they were called the Hospitallers. It's a mouthful. Hospital, it just means to be hospitable. We don't often associate the word hospital with good care and, open arms today. We live in a different world today, but that's where the word hospital comes. Or if you go to Europe and you're a 20-something and you just want to backpack around Europe, where are you going to stay? In a hostel. It's the same word, okay? So Jerusalem and these various cities in the Holy Land were being controlled primarily by the Knights Templar and the I can't say it. You know that word. Hospitallers, something like that. So when Saladin sets his sights on Jerusalem in 1187, King Richard I he's up in arms. We know Richard I, who is also known as Richard the Lionhearted, through Robin Hood. Right? Because when Richard went off to make war in the Holy Land, his conniving, scheming brother, John, gets left behind and is a lousy ruler. And so that's sort of how we know Richard from that. So Richard leads an army, and he defeats the Muslims at Arsuf in 1191. If you ever get a chance, there are a number of books written on the encounter between Saladin and Richard. They're fascinating. Richard, when he first got to the Holy Land, came down with some deathly illness, probably something endemic to the Middle East. And interestingly, Saladin asked for Richard to come and meet with him, gave him fruits and some of the sort of wined and dined him, if you will, Although a Muslim wouldn't wine and dine you, they would just dine you, right? Okay. And wanted to engage Richard, but wouldn't engage him until Richard was well. I mean, Saladin is an interesting character. He had a great deal of honor. He had a great deal of respect that was shown. And if you ever get a chance to particularly read about the encounter between Saladin and Richard, it's absolutely fascinating. In 1192, Richard and Saladin ultimately signed a peace treaty that reestablished the kingdom of Jerusalem. Although the kingdom of Jerusalem in the Holy Land did not include the city of Jerusalem because that was a Muslim stronghold. Richard took his troops and marched up to the walls of Jerusalem, but when he got there, he turned back and never pursued it. And then shortly thereafter went back to Europe and lived out his days as the King of England. Any questions on that? The third crusade is probably the most the most well-known, I guess, if you will. I use the phrase Holy Land because that's the context in which we're living. I don't ever use that phrase. I'm never going to go on a tour to the Holy Land. Okay? In fact, during today's sermon, hopefully you'll hear something that says, this is Holy Land. Because this is where God dwells. And so we need to put it in that context. Now, is the Middle East, particularly Israel, significant to us? Well, of course it is. But I have a friend who just got back from a trip to Israel. He said, oh, it was so thrilling to walk where Jesus walked. And I said, well, I do that every day. Again, we need to not unduly elevate. And I think part of the context for the Crusades was that land was so important. And for the, you know, when we look at Islam and we look at the expansion that they do, but that's what the Roman Catholic Church was doing too. I mean, often, in fact, we'll celebrate the 500th anniversary of the Reformation this year. But during that time in the early 16th century, what was the Roman Catholic Church doing? Well, it was expanding. And how was it expanding? By military force. During the Second Crusade, Bernard of Clairvaux preached a fiery sermon to sort of send the troops off. And his text was Paul's verse in Romans, compel them to come in. And they took that to mean by force. By force, we will compel them. It was very common in the Middle Ages to see the church's expansion primarily by military force and not by mission, by evangelism. One of the classic examples is Clovis, who was the king of the Franks in the 8th century, I think. In that day, if the king was worshiping a pagan god and wants to embrace the Christian god, so he comes to faith, whatever that means. Okay, it can mean a lot of different things. But if the king now says, I worship the triune God of the Hebrews, what do the people do? They worship the triune, yes. In fact, Clovis he wanted his troops to be baptized. So he had it was like 9,000 horsemen. He had his horsemen ride through the river, and he told his warriors to make sure that they were baptized, but to hold their sword arm above the water because that did not need to be baptized. So again, we look at this and we think, oh, this is, you know, this is crazy. But it was on both sides. It wasn't just one side. It was both sides. Yes, John.
I think the one distinguishing thing we need to make, though, is the scripture. call for the atrocities they're committing today.
Yeah, and we'll get there. We'll get there. Okay, hang with me. Okay, we're going to look at a lot of the Quran. However, the Holy Roman Empire used the scriptures to kill, maim, rape, destroy. Okay, so let's not lose sight of that. In the name of Jesus, horrible things have been, I'm spitting my candy out. Horrible things have been done. So, sorry about that, Marie. All right, where am I? Let's see if we can get through the Crusades today. All right, so the fourth Crusade, first three were pretty prominent. They were big things. Beginning with the fourth and really subsequent ones, they became less aimed at the Muslims, first of all. Second of all, they became more chaotic. Interestingly, the fourth crusade was waged against the Byzantine church, the Eastern church, and Constantinople. So the Holy Roman Empire wages war against the Orthodox Church, because they refused to submit to Rome. So in 1204, the West completely overran Constantinople. Interestingly, Constantinople is going to fall. 1492 is a very important year. We know it because Columbus sailed the blue, right, in 1492. We also know, last week I told you, that was the year that the Muslims were finally driven out of the Iberian Peninsula back into North Africa. It was also when Constantinople fell to the Muslims in 1492. There are a multitude of reasons why these things happened, but one of the things that sort of led to Constantinople falling was its weakened condition, because the Roman Catholic Church had undermined what was going on in the Eastern Church. And so you have all of these things at play. All right, so the Fourth Crusade aimed not at the Muslims at all, aimed at brothers in the East. The Fifth Crusade, the Final Crusades, I'll sort of go through these. Some of them really don't have numbers. Most of the remaining Crusades were aimed more towards dissenting groups, again, less against the Muslims. In 1208 and 1229, there was a crusade that was aimed against the heretics that were in Cathari and the Albigenses, both of whom were in France. And they were very successful, because both of those groups were almost completely destroyed, almost utterly wiped off the face of the earth. In 1211 to 1225, there was a crusade that went to recapture Transylvania. Where's Transylvania? Romania. It's in the mountainous region of Romania, in the northwest part of Romania, south of Hungary and the Czech Republic. So in that region, of course, we all know that area because of Vlad the Impaler. Wendy's been to his castle, right? Anybody else been to Vlad's castle in Transylvania? There are some characters in history, that is for sure. In 1212, we have the infamous Children's Crusade. There are lots of debates as to whether there were actually children, although there are some credible stories. Apparently, there was a very passionate 12 or 13-year-old who decided that God would be with them and they would go and make war against the Muslims. It was disastrous in the fact that all of them died. They all died. I mean, it was just an awful thing. In 1216, we have what we would call the Fifth Crusade. This one was put in motion by Pope Innocent III, the plan originally was to go and to attack Cairo, because Cairo had become a stronghold of Islam. recapture that city for the Holy Roman Empire. North Africa has very strategic consequences, does it not? What does Cairo give if you have Cairo? The Nile. So it gives you all of the area inland in order to control North Africa. And so Cairo, so they set their sights on Cairo and to recapture it, but the forces were defeated and they were forced to surrender. So that was a failure, the Fifth Crusade. In 1229, the Sixth Crusade was called by Emperor Frederick II, and what that did was it achieved a peaceful transfer of Jerusalem to the Crusaders. There was a negotiation with Al-Kamil, who was at that time the leader of the Muslims in that area. The peace treaty expired 10 years later, and the Muslims easily regained control of Jerusalem. One of the things that the Holy Roman Empire at this point had become so stretched that it was virtually impossible for them to maintain strongholds in far-reaching places. And it wasn't a time where you could hop on a plane and be there in a few hours. If you were going to the Holy Land, it would probably take you months to get there. Months. So Jerusalem fell in 1229. And essentially from that point on, Jerusalem has been controlled by the Muslims. That was part of the... I didn't really want to get into all that went on post-World War I or World War II. And really, there was a lot of sort of gerrymandering that was going on between World War I and World War II over the Middle East. A lot of the countries there, their borders were determined by us. We went in and we assassinated a few of the leaders in some of those countries. There were some things going on, and so you get to Iraq and you find out that, well, there's actually a conflict internally in Iraq. What's that between? Well, not just the Shiites and Sunnis, but the Kurds, because the Kurds didn't get Kurdistan that they wanted. Stan just means country or nation. So any of those nations that have Stan in it just means that they're a nation of Kurds, Kurdistan, Tajikistan, right? Pakistan, Afghanistan, that's just the nation of Afghans, okay? So the Kurds didn't get their country post-World War II, and so there was this constant internal conflict. Plus, they were looked down upon by the Sunni Iraqis, or Shiite Iraqis, no. Iraqis were Sunni. Sorry, and so you have the same conflict in Lebanon and Turkey, and then notwithstanding Turkey's centuries old conflict with the Greeks, I remember reading about how the Turks hated the Greeks and the Greeks hated the Turks, and I didn't quite understand that. Wendy was a Tupperware lady many moons ago, and her manager was she's about that tall, would you say? A little Greek lady. Yeah. And she had utter hatred for Turks. I remember asking her, have you ever met one? No. but there were, and again, culturally, we're sort of conditioned to our pasts. Let me say it this way. Our pasts have sort of been put in a pot and stirred together so that we have a very short history primarily for most of us. That hasn't always been the case. I mean, I grew up in a very small town of maybe 1,000 people. And in that town, you had, well, what we would call Dago Hill. That's what they called it, by the way, where all the Italians lived. You had, that's on one side, and then you go down to Main Street, you go up the other side, and that was Pollock Hill. Okay? And they all had their own church. Roman, the Italians had their Roman Catholic Church. The Poles had their Roman Catholic Church. On the other end of town, which you have another hill, that was called French Hill. So that's where all the French lived. When the town was established, I actually ended up growing up in a town called Swede Town. Well, the Swedes were non-Roman Catholics. So they weren't really looked to, we really would like you not to be living in town. We would like you to live out of town. Now, that was in the middle 19th century when Hastings was founded. But it's fascinating because those lines, even for those of us who remember those, are becoming less and less significant. Okay? Except for my Dutch brothers. They're all, and sisters. We all get it, yes? But those were so ingrained in the people during this time. And so it's hard for us to sort of understand what's really going on. And nationalism is really on the rise at this point as well. Yes?
When my son was in the army, he was an Arabic interrogator, and he said to me, he said, it's hard for us to understand, you know, the Quran and all Islam and all that. He said, because they've been fighting for centuries. And he said, you can't get them to sit down at a table and talk together. They're not going to do it.
Yes. So, yeah, it is hard. So your son is an Arabic translator. And it is hard because you have that centuries long, and because for most of the most of Muslims, they don't think back 100 years or 200 years. They're thinking back thousands of years to think about what went on. We'll talk about the results of the Crusades here in a moment, and hopefully we can sort of tie that all together. I've gotten way off track here. Where are we? Seventh Crusade, 1248 to 1254. This was organized by King Louis IX, again aimed at Egypt. And Louis leads his forces against Egypt and is utterly destroyed. So almost all of the Crusades following were disorganized, they weren't well thought out, and so they were usually failures. In this context, during this time, the Mamluks, who were descended from Muslim slaves, took power over much of the Middle East. So I want you to think about that. The Islam changed its face during the 13th century. Because during that time, many of the people who had been enslaved by Muslims now had risen to power because they had embraced Islam, probably were forced to, I would assume. If you were a slave and you didn't follow Islam, you were just probably executed. So now you have the Mamluks who come to power in the Middle East, and it changes the shape of the Middle East and and what's going on there. In 1270, Louis IX organizes another crusade to go to Palestine, although they are diverted for some reason, probably a storm on the Mediterranean, are turned toward Tunis, where Louis IX died. Tunis is in North Africa. It's Tripoli. You have that little hook on the top of Lebanon. They're all right there, west of Egypt. Then in 1271, and again, so this would have been the Eighth Crusade here. So I told you there were seven, but you know, it depends who's counting. The Ninth and Final Crusade was led by Edward I into the Holy Land, and they essentially didn't accomplish anything. And at this point, Europe is now in the beginnings of the Renaissance. So you have... you have other interests, you have other things going on there. Europe is pretty much contained. So there's Islam is no longer a threat to the West at this point. And so they sort of just go about their business from that point on. And the Crusades came to a close. Now, what I want to do is talk about the results of the Crusades, because what happened during this time is that some of the conflicts that we see today, they have their shape being formed during this time. While the Crusades ultimately resulted in defeat for Europeans, many argue that they successfully extended the reach of Christianity and Western civilization. The Roman Catholic Church experienced an increase in wealth, and the power of the Pope was elevated after the Crusades ended. So it was at least successful for the Pope, even though right after the last Crusade, you have what is often referred to as the Babylonian captivity of the Church. You have multiple popes. You have one in Rome. You've got one in Avignon. You've got a third who says, no, I'm the real Pope. And so you've got all sorts of chaos going on in the Roman Catholic Church as well. But it consolidated power to the Roman Catholic Church, and primarily in the person of the Pope. Yes, John? So the question is, weren't the Crusades essentially to gain territory and power? Well, if you would argue that the Roman Catholic Church had claim to the Holy Lands, then yes, that was their intent, is that they were trying to expand their territory. And they, again, the Roman Catholic Church they're not just aimed at the Muslims. They're also actively expanding their territory in other ways. You have missionaries who have gone into Rus, which we now call Russia, and sort of shape some of that area as well. Yeah, Andy.
It was also trade. They saw Africa as a continent they could easily control. There were no armies there. And that was the land route to Africa and control.
Right. So, yes. Yeah, so often, yeah, particularly Africa was seen in terms of its resource value. Trade routes. And ultimately, it wasn't the Roman Catholic Church, but it was the European nations who overtook Africa and South America, and to a large extent, Southeast Asia. And so a lot of those areas were being, do I dare use this word? Sure. Exploited by Europeans for their own good. We wanted to maintain the spice road. We wanted to maintain the Silk Road. We wanted to maintain all of those things. Yes, somebody else. Go ahead, Andy.
Well, if you think about the Crusades, and their result was that they proved that logistically they couldn't continue a land route to Africa and to Asia, then what happens right after that? They start sailing, trying to find a sea route.
Right, that's right, right. Probably The primary motivation to recapture the Middle East was that was the most direct route to where they wanted to go. And so once that gets cut off, now you got to find alternatives. And so then you have the age of sailing and discovery, Magellan and all of, Ponce de Leon, we all know from, found the Fountain of Youth here. Yes, and I tried to capture that a little bit. Trade and transportation improved throughout Europe as well during this time. As a result of the Crusades, the wars created a constant demand for supplies and transportation. We have experienced that through the years. There was a tremendous boom. What happened prior to World War II? What do we call that?
Depression.
The Great Depression. Yeah, one of the primary mechanisms that got us out of the Great Depression was World War II. It tends to, because demand for goods and services just goes skyrockets. And so that was certainly true here. And it also resulted in shipbuilding, manufacturing, various supplies. It began to reshape the sailing industry. You begin to see more, because at this point, sailing was still very dangerous. Even on the Mediterranean Sea, it was very dangerous to sail. And so they began to build bigger ships, they began to have bigger crews, better trained mariners, and so you begin to see a shift in the way that Europe particularly was functioning. And I think it's important for us to understand, during this time, the Europeans are coming out of what we often call the Dark Ages. There was widespread illiteracy. There was lots of things that sort of held Europe back, where the centers of flourishing culture were in the Middle East and in Asia. Those were the places where culture was flourishing. Well, in the European nations, they weren't. It really wasn't. It wasn't until the Renaissance began in the late 13th or early 14th century. Again, that's not to say that there wasn't anything happening. There were plenty of things happening. All right, very quickly. After the Crusades, there was a heightened interest in travel and learning throughout Europe, which some historians believe may have paved the way for the Renaissance. It did, I think, open the door to that. And then finally, and I think this is most important for us, and we'll pick up on this as we begin looking at the specific teachings of Islam next week. Not next week, 2 weeks from now. In the Muslim world, the Crusaders were regarded as immoral, bloody, and savage. The ruthless and widespread massacre of Muslims, Jews, and other non-Christians resulted in bitter resentment that persisted for many years. Even today, some Muslims derisively refer to the West's involvement in the Middle East as a crusade. In fact, they often will refer to us as crusaders, meddling in places we ought not to meddle. So, and that has shaped much of the discourse that goes on today. I do want us to look, as John has pointed out, I do want us to look at what does the Quran teach? And we're going to look at a lot of passages. And it's not quite as clear-cut as we would like it to be. But I hope that we'll be able to sort of get a sense or understand. The question John raised last week was, I made the reference to radical Islam, and John's point is, are they truly radical, or is Islam by its nature radical? And so we'll try to look at that as well as we move forward. Okay? Yes, John.
Did the Crusades, the one thing I didn't see listed there, did the Crusades result in the containment of the expansion of Islam?
Okay, so the question is, did the Crusades result in the containment of Islam? I would say just historically, yes. Essentially, their expansion stopped at that point. They reached into some of the eastern, Constantinople fell, so Turkey and that region that had been a sort of a bastion of Eastern Church fell. But for the most part, yes, it did put an end because the lines were being more clearly drawn at that point. I've gone